Today, we have the good fortune of interviewing Father Malachi Martin in his home in New York. And Father Martin has written many books, his most recent being The Keys of This Blood. And we will be discussing the many conflicts raging throughout the world. We should begin by asking, why are so many conflicts occurring? We see wars and conflicts raging in the Middle East, in Ireland, in Central America, in Central Europe, and in many places where you wouldn't expect it. We had even an armed confrontation in Canada last year. What's going on here, do you think?
Well, Bernard, I think it's very simple to say what's going on, but it's a bit difficult to grasp it immediately. Briefly, it's this. If you take a survey of the world, say take a survey of North America, Canada, the United States, and Latin America, and then of Western Europe, and of Africa and the Middle East, and the Far East, you'll find one central issue always coming out. Everywhere, Christianity is in recess. Everywhere, the idea of God's rule, of God's law, as promulgated by Christ and as maintained in the tradition of the Christian church, is in recess. And what God is saying to us, really, by these events, is briefly this, look, as a community of nations, you are bloodstained with guilt. You're bloodstained with guilt on account of your anti-life stance. You're bloodstained with guilt on account of your greed. You have deserted my altars, and therefore I'm leaving you to your own devices. And death is going to take over as long as you pursue this course. In other words, it's really an extension of what Our Lady said at Fatima, into which we will go later on in this conversation, at least I would like to touch on it, that what is happening is that God is allowing the greed and the avarice and the cruelty of man to run its course, since man as a community of nations are deserting him. That's, I think, the basic reason why. And now added to that, which we must touch on too, Bernard, I'd love to talk about, is the fact that most Catholics in the world today are confused. They are deeply confused about what is right, what is wrong. Is there a just war going on in the Gulf? Is it right for us to deal with the guerrillas in Latin America the way we're doing? What should we do about South Africa, which is shortly going to become a different nation, and the conflicts in Southeast Asia? What are we to do about it all? Where's the directive? There's no clear clarion voice speaking to Catholics. So that is the difficulty. But the overall picture, I think, is explained by the fact that everywhere you can turn, name one country where you wouldn't find that Christianity and Catholicism is in recess. Recess in its faith, recess in its influence, recess in its way of life. And therefore God, you know, when a man drinks too much, Bernard, he doesn't send an angel to punish him. He lets him drink too much and he ruins his organism. And if he takes drugs, we can take drugs for our diseases and etc. But if you exaggerate with drugs, you're going to kill yourself. God doesn't send an angel to say, hey, stop taking drugs. No, no, no. He allows the sanction of nature to work. There's a sanction of human nature in the community of nations working here. And I guess, as one Pope Pius X once said, what will happen, he said, is the men will be fighting and starting conflagrations between nations, and then brush fires will start out behind them. They'll start to put that out. No sooner will they have that one out than another one starts, and then a fourth and a fifth and a sixth. And finally, the remnant will raise their hands to heaven and say, God, we need you. We need your help.
And so man is relying on himself and it just isn't working.
It can't work. It can't work because God took over the world with the birth of a baby called Jesus. And that man's rule, the rule of God, through the God-man Jesus Christ, has been rejected concretely by the nations as a whole. They do not act for his sake. They do not act according to his law. They're not extending his rule. And therefore, he is leaving them to their own devices. And therefore, that's where we are today as regards explaining what is happening today around us. It's a bad time from that point of view.
Now, the conflict then that you seem to be setting up is that of the rule of God versus the rule of man.
Yes. You see, Bernard, there's a great myopia, blindness about this. It's not sufficient in God's eyes that individual members of a nation worship God. And say in America or Canada, I am sure that a good majority believe in God and worship him in their hearts. That's not enough. Christ has a social kingdom and a political kingdom. His law must govern the parliaments, and they must govern the sociological developments. They don't any longer. We're introducing paganism throughout all our governments in the West, and that's been translated into governments in Africa because they're imitating us. And therefore, the rule of Christ is not any longer honored in human organization. And he's leaving those organizations to their own destruction. He has always done that, and he's doing it now.
And what have the popes said about the rule of God in the social order?
The popes have insisted, especially at the beginning of this century. You see, Bernard, their remarks and their teaching about the community of nations started to come to the fore when nations started getting together. And it's only in the 1900s and in our century, which is the last century of this millennium, that they found themselves confronted with a real society of nations being bound more and more closely together, usually because they were trying to kill each other and they had to make a new agreement after World War I and then after World War II, after having killed off how many, 70 million more human beings, they had another agreement in the United Nations and that fell to pieces in the Cold War. So now there's a new community of nations gathered around the United Nations Security Council, and the new commercial and political unity of all nations together. And now the popes have come into a full-blown teaching about what they should do. And the primary thing laid down is that all nations, and above all the community of nations, must acknowledge Christ. Otherwise, it can't work. It can't work. And we will stagger from brushfire to brushfire, conflagration to conflagration, until finally men find out they can't do it by themselves. And they may then turn to God. Our Lady's promise was that she would appear at a certain moment and save them from self-destruction. And that would be the beginning of a turnaround, the end game, as it were. We are in the end game now of nations.
And why has man in this century seem to have abandoned God and seem to more and more try to put the emphasis on solving his problems by himself?
Well, that started way back a couple of hundred years ago, Bernard, because, you see, there has always been, and above all from the 16th and 17th century onwards, that's four centuries ago, a group of men arose who said religion is nonsense. This idea of God in heaven, pie in the sky when you die, as they said derisively, and of hell beneath with the devil there waiting for you if you commit sins and die in sins. This is all superstition, hocus pocus. Man can do anything. The sky is made of steel and the earth is made of bronze. We have only got our bodies and our organisms and our minds, which are material anyway. We can build a perfect paradise here if we get rid of hocus pocus, if we get rid of religion, which has hampered man from achieving his destiny. Now that has grown into a faith and a credo, a real religion, on the part of millions who live as if God didn't exist. You see, it's not enough for you to say, I believe in God, and then do nothing about it. If you believe in God and in Christ, he must therefore have some, that must have some effect in your daily life. And in your daily life and the daily life of your community and your city and your state and your federal government. Otherwise, it's a sham. Now, that is not taking place at the present moment. Now, into that comes something else, which is very, very particular to us Roman Catholics, and it's this. We know that since the creation of the world, there has been in contention with Christ, the cosmic king, the king of the cosmos, and the creator, there has been in contention another entity whom we called Lucifer, and we call Satan. Everything we know from the saints, and from the popes, by the way, from the 19th and 20th century on, tells us that our particular century is the crisis time in that 2,000-year-old battle between Christ and Satan. And if we are to be quite frank about it, we must say that the huge increase in sin, public sin, legislated sin, say in abortion or euthanasia, and in the spread of pornography, and in the anti-life stance for euthanasia, etc., all that we must put down to an intense activity on the part of Satan, because according to everything we know from revelations and from what the popes have said and saints have said, these are his last days of triumph amongst the nations of men before Our Lady and Our Lord come, and Our Lord slays him with the word of his mouth, and Our Lady stops him in mid-track because she is all-powerful under her son. So we're witnessing, I think, the slope up to the crisis point of the big battle between Lucifer and Mary the Virgin, the Mother of God.
And all these conflicts that are going on throughout the world are part of this cosmic battle between Lucifer and Christ.
That's right. And you see, do you remember the policy of scorched earth that Hitler had when he had to leave France or Belgium or Holland or Germany itself, drawing back into his little bunker in Berlin? He burnt everything, destroyed everything, killed everything, as Saddam Hussein did in Kuwait. Well, you can refer to the present activity of the devil as scorched earth. He knows the end is on him. He knows that what he can take now is all he can take, like those Iraqis fleeing out of Kuwait City with trucks full of loot and booty. Only to be caught, by the way, by the American forces, and most of them didn't get away with it. But the devil is trying to make away with as many souls as he can before the time comes when he knows it's over, his reign is finished, and the world will return to the worship of Christ and of God. So that's where we are. Now, this, of course, is impenetrable for the non-Christian mind. And for many Catholic minds, they don't even think about this. Because A, the belief in the devil, and by the way, you must believe in the devil, otherwise you're not a Catholic. Belief in the devil is something that has disappeared. Many bishops don't believe in the devil. Many priests and nuns don't believe in the devil. They laugh at it. They teach the very opposite. There are catechisms in this country, the United States, and I'm sure in Canada, which say that this was once upon a time an idea we had, but that now we know that there's no such thing, that the devil is a creation of our minds. And that all we have are sinful structures created by, say, the Yankee imperialism or gross capitalism. But the idea of a devil, a being going around tempting you and causing you to sin, and to whom you say, yes, I shall offend God, I shall break his law, this we don't admit any longer. In fact, somebody has said it's the best PR job ever done, because he doesn't exist. And what spy would not be happy to be known not to exist and to continue his work undercover? And that is what is being done. That is what is happening to us. So I think that's the root of the crisis. Now, it won't do to go to the Canadian House of Parliament and say, you've got to listen to this fact that the devil is working among you. They would laugh at you. And similar to the US Congress, or to the British House of Parliament, or the French Chambre des Députés, or any government today in the West, so-called enlightened, they would say, they wouldn't even say what the Athenians said to Paul. We'll talk about this some other day. They'd say, we will never talk with you about this. Don't invite that man back again. So that, you see, it's unbelief, which ties again into Our Lady's cry about unbelief, undoing the world at Fatima, when she said that to Lucia in one of her revelations. So that's the situation where it is, and that's the root of it all. Now, we must add in that there are men and women dedicated to spreading the reign of Lucifer all over the world, especially in the United States. Do you know, Bernard, that in this year, 1991, there were 8,000 covens, satanic covens, in the United States alone. 8,000. And they're not simply ignorant men. They're brokers, lawyers, doctors, architects, priests, bishops, some cardinals, nuns, and their formal worship is to worship Satan as the prince of this world. So it has gone very far. The reign of Satan is upon us. And the anguish that many Catholics feel, and the anguish many priests feel and many bishops feel, good priests and good bishops and good people, is due to the fact they know the battle is, for the moment, doing terrible devastation to them, and that there's no hope, there's no upturn in our misery for the moment. It's simply black, arid desert.
Let's take a look at the geopolitical situation and this area of the social order, and start with the Middle East.
Well, the Middle East is a very particular case because now our interest is focused there, Bernard. And on the face of it, it looks like this. There was a man called Saddam Hussein al-Tikriti, dictator of Baghdad for nearly 20 years now, a murderer and an assassin. By the way, his earliest job was as an assassin, a hired assassin. This man is, he's not immoral, he's amoral. He is guilty of heinous personal crimes, and then of creating a system over there which rivals that of Hitler, complete with his Gestapo. He called it the Mohabarata, 125,000 employees, employed solely to spy on the Iraqis and to cut out dissenters, kill them, assassinate them, tell the families they were assassinating them, to spy out everything. This man invaded Kuwait, raped it, robbed it, stripped it, killed its citizens, and then insisted that it was always a part of Iraq, which was a lie, by the way. Kuwait was always independent. It was never part of the Ottoman Empire. It has been independent since 1756. But you see, Saddam is like his father, Satan, whom Christ described as the great liar and the great murderer. He is satanic in his behavior, whether he's a Satanist formally or something else. Now, Kuwait is a very great ally and friend of Britain. Most of the money in the British treasury is Kuwaiti money. They depend on it. We depend on Kuwaiti oil and on Saudi Arabian oil. And there was no doubt about that Saddam was going for Saudi. So we rushed over with an expeditionary force. We reinforced that over 4 or 5 months. We then made that into an offensive force by November. And by January 15, with the 10 or 12 votes in the Security Council, we went to war. And in 100 hours, we routed his arms and his armies. Now, why this? Well, on the face of it, people would say, well, Saddam Hussein was greedy. We had to stop him. That cannot be quite exact. Because the Chinese were very, very greedy about Tibet, to the point that they killed off 1 million Tibetans and drove 1.2 million into exile. We remained great, very great friends with Tibet. We didn't object. And Mr. Gorbachev has refused to let go of the Baltics. He has killed members of the Baltic states. We haven't really objected. We've done nothing about it whatever. We have sort of said, this is not kosher, this is not decent and nice, but that's far from sending an expeditionary force. That's far even from sending a representative over there to say to the Lithuanians and the Estonians and Latvians, we're with you, or from making a strong process with Mr. Gorbachev. Why? Well, we're friends with Mr. Gorbachev, and we're friends with the Chinese. And nobody ever stood up when Russia invaded Afghanistan and said, get out or else. No. Because our vital interests, as we were told, were not involved there. The Indonesian government has been killing the inhabitants of an island called East Timor, the Timorese, for the last 15 years. It's genocide. We know it. Everybody knows it. Nothing is done about it. Nothing is done about it at all. Mr. Gaddafi of Libya has been oppressing the people in Chad for ever so long with missiles, with gas, with bayonet charges, with bombs, with soldiers. He's killed thousands, tens of thousands. We haven't sent an expeditionary force. No. We don't act out of moral good. We act out of vital interests. Now,
so we're viewing our interests solely in material terms now.
Yes, but there's an added factor to add into it, and it's this. It's what Mr. Bush has accustomed us to know as the New World Order. We have to deal with this at length, but put it like this. Assad Hussein cannot fit into the New World Order. No dictator can of that kind. He had to be got rid of, not because he was unjust, not because he looted Kuwaiti, not because he killed off people, not because he imprisoned his own populace, but because he would refuse to fit into the general scheme of the New World Order. That's why we're really there. You see, Bernard, when we talk about the New World Order, you'll have to remember that the architects of the New World Order have only two obstacles in their way: Christianity and Islam. Now, Christianity is already mold and honeycombed. It's a weakened structure. It has no political influence, no armies, no parliamentary influence, no cultural influence any longer, really, in the world. And therefore, it is already taken as an institution. Islam is different. Stretching from Algiers to Indonesia, there are 800 million Muslims. And their characteristic up to this has been irredentism. That is, they will not change. They reject us as infidels. They regard us as unclean and sinful. Up to this. That had to be changed if there was going to be a new world order grouping all the society of nations together, especially a group of nations like those in the Middle East who hold oil. And oil is essential for the world at the present moment until scientists come up with a non-oil source of energy, which they will, but at the present moment we depend on that. So I think Saddam Hussein gave the architects of the New World Order the chance to infiltrate Islam. Now, for the first time, the Saudis are permitting a foreign army on their soil, and they're permitting foreign habits as regards women. They needn't carry veils any longer. They can even fight in the armies. This was abhorrent. And you would be killed if you went in certain parts of Saudi Arabia on the spot by any Saudi, and the government would laud him. You'd be killed by the police. It's sacred. We infidels couldn't touch it. That's all changed. So we've started leavening Islam with a view to integrating them into the family of nations.
So there's going to be a liberalization of Islam the same way that there's been a liberalization of the Christian
churches.
That's
right. That's right. To leaven it and make it conform to the ideas of the New World Order.
Let's talk about the New World Order just briefly. What are the key ideas of the New World Order?
The key ideas of the New World Order is this. You see, if you examine what we did after the First World War, we tried to have a balance of power. And it didn't succeed. Hitler and Mussolini and Chojo and the Japanese rose up. So then we had the Second World War. At the end of the Second World War, we said, okay, well, we'll balance, have a balance of power between the Soviet Union and us and keep the peace. It didn't work because of what the Soviet Union was like. Now we have arrived at a very ancient idea, by the way. We're not the first to think of it, that the key to world peace is not a balance of power, but a community of power. And this is the first time we've had a community of power. Listen, if you can imagine people who lived in the 40s and 50s and are now dead, if they knew only that in the fall of 1990, all nations except a few, 98% of nations, voted together to have an expedition to put down one aggressor. I mean, that never happened. And 33 nations contributed material and men and money. This. There was a moral consensus that never existed in the world before. This is a community of power. Therefore, that an aggressor will be jumped upon by all nations in concert, systematically, and they will crush him. So it's Mr. Gorbachev, when he met with President Bush at Helsinki, said it very well. He said, today, no one nation can afford exclusive leadership. Now it's the leadership of the community of power. We're all onto this. It's community of power. And that's why Saddam couldn't last. There was this moral consensus. So the New World Order is built on a community of power and overwhelming power. There always has to be somebody like the United States, which has the economic pull-out power, the military clout, and the mind, a democratic mind, which doesn't go into a country to take it over, but goes into a country to liberate it from undemocratic, as we call it, people who are trying to take it over or run things or do damage to the whole community. So that's the first note of the New World Order. It's going to be based on a community of power, not on American leadership or Russian leadership or European leadership or leadership of any one nation or any one empire, but on the community of nations. Because now we are a family. We're a family. That's number one. Number two, it's based on economic unity. Why that? Well, you see, in 1860, for instance, 1850, in the 1800s, the USA needn't trade with anybody. It could exist by itself. It didn't need anybody. Britain did, by the way, small island. We didn't. Today, there is no nation, including us, that can't exist without trade. We would sink beneath the waves next week if we didn't trade. We have to have export and import trade to live. But we're not the only ones. Everybody must. You know, there were two nations that resisted the Western capitalism for a long time. One was run by the so-called Robin Hood of the Mediterranean, Fidel Castro. And the other was called the Albania, the hermetic crab of the Adriatic Sea, where it is. And they would have nothing to do with us. Now they're screaming for trade. They know they can't exist. No nation can exist without trade. It must trade and be traded with. That means money. That means capitalism. That means amicable relations, diplomatic relations. So everybody has to do that. Now, whether we know it or not, that is now coming to a head in a thing called GATT, the General Agreement of Tariffs and Trade. That is an arrangement which will be concluded by the end of April between 168 leading nations and therefore taking in all nations, according to which no nation can trade, export, or import unless it conforms to the rules laid down by an international committee, which won't be completely exclusively American or European or Russian. It'll be a general transnational committee. And that means that we are locked into a one-world economic system. They'll tell you how much to import and how much to export, what not to import, what not to export, and what to charge for it. So we're going to lose our certain economic liberties, and so is everybody. So it's one-world economic system. Then there is the brute fact, which most people like you and me can never realize fully. You know, I can't count $1 billion. I can't count even a million. I have never had it. I don't want a million. But I can't even count a billion. It defies my imagination. Yet, on the world markets, the world money markets, every day, say in Singapore or in Tokyo or Rome or Dusseldorf or Paris or New York, there are men, mainly men, some women, but very few women, mainly men who play on those markets every day, investing, de-investing, with over $30 or $40 billion. They're very rich men. They're not bad men. No, they're very wealthy. And they're men who have transnational interests. They have timber in Malaysia, and they have rubber in Brazil, and they have gold in the Soviet Union or in South Africa, and they have corn elsewhere, and cars and car parts and electronic equipment. They have interests everywhere. They are transnational men. They're Americans or Chinese or Russians or French or Brazilians, but they have lost all that. They have a passport for one country, probably, but they live everywhere because their interests are everywhere. Now, they govern the daily flow of capital and capital goods. No nation can exist without that flow of capital, and no nation can exist without the flow of capital goods. They govern that, and they ultimately decide when a recession is going to take place or when a depression is going to take place. They ultimately decide if a government is going to stand, because every week a government must pay its bills, at least if not every day. And that money is capital money. It's funny money. It's not in cash. It's funny money. It's on paper, but it's real wealth. Now, they govern all that. And that flow of capital and capital goods means that we are already within the engrenage, the mechanism, as they say, of a one-world financial system. So the New World Order implies, therefore, it implies a one-world economic system based on a one-world financial system run by transnational people who have no particular loyalty to any particular country because all their interests are everywhere. Sure, they were born in Kansas, or they were born in Brazil, or they were born in Hong Kong, but they have risen above that because their interests are national, transnational. Their interests are not national, they're transnational. So those are the three notes of the New World Order. In other words, it's based on a community of power, a consensus, that we will stand together against anybody who disrupts this arrangement of the society of nations as an organization. It's based on a one-world economic order that's run by a central supranational agency, a government. These are governmental decisions. And that is based ultimately on the sinews of power, money. Money. As somebody said in the 16th, 17th century, Mayor Rothschild, I don't care what form of government they have, just let me dominate their money. And that is the key to it all. There's one last note to be pointed out about the New World Order. God has no part. It is not the rule of God. It is not based on morality or immorality. It's based on profit. And it's based on the gods that go with it. Greed, preferences, selfishness, mercilessness. You are barefoot, Bernard. I make shoes that cost you $20. You haven't got $20? Sorry, pal, you've got to go barefoot. I produce wheat and baby formula. You have 4 children. You need it. It will cost you about $40 a month. You haven't got $40? Sorry, they'll have to starve. The system is built on profit. It's non-moral. It depends on the capitalist if he has morality. If he hasn't got morality, there is none. The New World Order is not based on anything. Now, there's a very difficult point for a lot of Catholics, especially Americans, but also Canadians and British, to realize here. We're always talking about let the church stay away from politics. No politicking priests. The Pope shouldn't be talking politics. Keep the priest in the sacristy and let him stay in the pulpit, but let him stay out of the political voting booth. There's this idea, the funny idea, that the church is out of place. And what the church has to say is out of place in the secular order. In the public marketplace, no religion, please. Now, God insists that anything a man does, especially in community, especially about the human race, must be dominated by his rule. But it isn't. We know that. And therefore, this new world order is not the rule of God. And as the present Pope doesn't tire saying, it cannot succeed. It's going to unravel. And by the way, unraveling it is in front of our eyes with the contentions and the wars. Look, last year, once we made peace with Mr. Gorbachev and the Berlin Wall fell down and the 5 European nations and the Eastern satellite nations of Soviet Union suddenly were free, as we all thought, and Mr. Gorbachev was having capitalist dreams and we were giving credits and food and we were to the Russians, to the Soviets, and Mr. Gorbachev became Gorby, Gorby, Gorby for everybody in the Western world, Italy, Rome, France, Spain, Belgium, England, America, Canada. The idea that 1 year later we would have an army of 750,000 fighting in the Middle East, people would have horse laughed if you had proposed it, and yet that's what happened. Now we think we've got rid of Saddam Hussein. Well, we're going to have a difficult time winning the peace, but we're going to do it because we're dominant, because our armies have routed him. Bernard, wait for 6 months. There's going to be another brush fire somewhere. And again, we'll rush off to put that one off. Because it can't succeed. Because finally, it is the gods of greed and avarice and selfishness and domination and just humanism without God that sit on the top dais and say, do this, do that, do the other. And behind them, invisible, is the grinning figure of Satan.
Well, the money men are always talking about limiting the population and the size of families.
They are. You see, it's the most amazing statement, Bernard. I'll tell you why. If you look at the countries, the black Sahara countries, you'll find that demographically, their populations are not adequate for tilling the land. They're underpopulated. And yet those African countries are the very ones on which International Planned Parenthood are concentrating to spread the use of contraception, to limit the population more. There is this funny, funny principle, which is really the great death wish. It's a demonic energy on which the world is now running. Limit the population, because if you limit the population, then you have less expenses, and you can dragoon people much more, and you have them under your control. And then you can say, well, we will allow 4 million in Kenya this year, and 3 million there, because economically that doesn't demand much foreign aid, and we can deal with that situation, and we can use it. But more than that, they will have to prosper and make money that we want to make. It's a different thing. And besides that, that also increases the population of people who could oppose the system which we want to use. That's the idea behind it. So the organizers, and then they know that they can't do that unless they start with a child in school. Therefore, they abhor any education that's not theirs, which is a totally secular education, as we're now getting in the United States, and as I think you're getting in Canada too. In the mind of Satan, in the mind of the original source of the idea of the New World Order, because it is satanic in its ultimate inspiration, because it's a world without God, in his mind, this is a way of destroying the presence of the Trinity. If you can totally secularize education and thus rid the children of any religious interpretation or meaning or sense in their own lives, if you can do that to the family, make divorce very easy, allow homosexual marriages so that marriage between man and woman is just an alternative, and if you can spread homosexuality, give them rights, civil rights, federal rights, state rights, give them rights in every possible way, then you proceed to destroy the idea of marriage. Now, Bernard, unless there's an institution called marriage, husband and wife, and between them a covenant with God, within which they produce children, according to the laws of God, that means the Trinity, as a working unit within the human race, is disappearing. It's not in their hearts, it's not in their lives, and their married lives. And therefore, in the ultimate idea of Satan, it is to bring the human race to the point that it is simply a flat, level thing of equals, all equal in their misery, without the Trinity. And that's why the New World Order doesn't want Christian education, and that's why it doesn't want Christian marriage, and why it will foster homosexual way of life as an alternative lifestyle, and why it would have lesbian parents, and will allow sex experimentation and fetal experimentation. Look, can you imagine the pathos of, say, 30 embryos lying in a refrigerator in the Maryland laboratory that does these things? Those are all souls, human souls, imprisoned, alive, and kept there. Think of the joy that gives Satan. Those souls can't be touched by baptism. And they can be destroyed at the twist of a scalpel if they don't succeed in some experimentation. This is the destruction of the human family as Christ originally planned it. And remember, what is the desecration there for us Catholics? But I'll tell you very simply. The human family was supposed to reproduce the family of God. God the Father, God the Son, and the love of the Holy Ghost between them, with Our Lady as the mother of the human race that will produce, and the mother of God himself. That's the paradigm. That's the heavenly image according to which on earth the family should be built. And that's what Christianity did. It taught men to rear families, create families, in imitation of that divine thing. And thus the Trinity was perpetuated by grace and by doctrine and by Our Lord and Our Lady and the angels and the entire gamut of the Christian revelation. That is being liquidated. And therefore the Trinity is being destroyed. And therefore Satan has his victory over Jesus. He's nullifying Calvary. He's wiping out salvation. And he's producing a list of people who can't go to heaven. Now, the point I'd love to stress, ending this part of it, is this, that in no way, as the present Pope says, in no way can this succeed. It cannot have God's blessing. It's going to lead to further and further and further difficulties. We all thought that everything was going to be fine once Gorbachev became like us and the Soviet Union stopped being against us. It didn't. We're now at war again. Now we're going into a peace. And we won't say, well, now we've dealt with it. Oh, no, we have not. The next brush fire is behind our backs. The match is already to the tinder. It's going to burst out. And then we'll rush to put out that saying, well, this will be the end of it all. It won't be. It won't be. It won't be. It's going to unravel again. Because why? God is allowing us to be eaten up by the sanctions built into our race. As Augustine said, we were made for you, O God, and our hearts are restless until they rest in thee.
Now, you had mentioned Gorbachev just recently. Mm. What is the role of Russia in all these problems and in all this scenario of increasing conflict?
Well, I'll tell you, if you really want to look at Gorbachev in the light of truth and reality, you have to talk about Our Lady and you have to talk about Fatima. You can study the geopolitics of Gorbachev and admire his agility, by the way. This man is one of the cleverest geopoliticians we've known of in history. And the continual cry that he's just about to be beheaded, decapitated, or he's going to be ousted, or he'll be killed, or he'll lose power. It's such a joke. Every month he acquires more power. Every year he's more powerful. We even called him a man of peace and gave him the Nobel Peace Prize. And he was on the cover of Time. Oh, this man is marvelous. Again, public relations. Marvelous instinct for a profile among the nations. Now, but if you look at him from the point of view of the church, the only sure word we have about him is from Our Lady. Now, Our Lady was very clear in Fatima in 1917 on October 13. She was very clear about it all. And in the previous months, talking to the children, she said that the errors of the land, which Gorbachev now dominates, and of which he is the figurehead and the chief agent, the errors of that will spread everywhere unless certain conditions were met. We didn't meet those conditions, by the way. The Pope of 1960, good Pope John the 23rd, was supposed to fulfill those conditions. He didn't, for his own reasons. And therefore, Our Lady said beforehand, she said way back in 1917, if they do not do this, if they don't fulfill my mandate, then certain things will follow. Two things chiefly. Unfaith will reign. The faith will be withdrawn. God will withdraw grace from Christians and from the world. And number two, the world will be punished by catastrophes the world has never seen yet. Now, Mr. Gorbachev is the key in that because he is the most powerful man in Russia, in the Soviet Union. We have to bow our heads, therefore, to a fact that in God's plan, and it's purely arbitrary, but God can do what he likes because he's God, in God's plan, salvation is not going to come from the West on the wings of our bombers and in our marvelous planes and in our marvelous fighting men. There's no salvation there. Salvation is going to come from the East. And it's not going to come because Mr. Gorbachev becomes a Christian and puts a crease in his trousers and adopts capitalism. No, he's not going to do any of those things anyway. It's going to come because she has chosen Russia as the place to operate the first great change, and it will teach the world, not because it's Russia, but because she chose to convert Russia at the last moment before the final crack, which will swallow us all up. And that is the message of Fatima, that Mr. Gorbachev willingly, this man with the sign of Cain on his forehead, the sign of the murderer, this man is a harbinger of the destiny of Russia in God's choice. Why did God choose that? I don't know. Will I ask God about it? No, you never question somebody who has absolute power. He has chosen that. Why? We don't know. I rather guess it is because, apart from the rulers of Russia, the people are a very humble, believing people. And in the West, we have grown fat with materialism. We're fat cats. We have a way of life the whole world wants. We're comfortable. And our sins are the sins of those who needn't sin at all. We needn't sin. We are so comfortable medically and scientifically and socially and politically compared to the rest of the world that we have the luxury to seek out God in a new way. We haven't. We've just sunk deeper into our sins, our sensuality, our materialism. We've forgotten God to a large extent as a system, the Western system. So that she has chosen that because that's the way she has decided with God the world is to be saved and the kingdom of Christ, the rule of God, is to be installed once again amongst men, for a brief period anyway. So that's where Mr. Gorbachev must be understood as that. Otherwise, if you try and reason your way through Mr. Gorbachev, he is inexplicable. How this man has succeeded, and why he succeeded, and why we foment him, we treat him as a friend. He can do anything. He can kill Georgians, and he can kill Armenians. He can kill people in the Baltics, deprive them of their liberty, refuse it, and we still give him the supplies we give him and the credits we give him. We still allow him to make missiles, which he promised not to make. We allowed him to support Saddam Hussein through the war. We didn't do anything about it. We have this funny, there is a reason for the way we collaborate with him, and that's something, another theme which we must speak about, why we do permit Gorbachev to get away with it. But the essence of Mr. Gorbachev, I think for any intelligent Catholic or Christian today, must the intelligent way of understanding him is within the framework of Fatima. Otherwise, it's a jungle. It's a jungle. There's no rational explanation that would satisfy my mind.
Are the communists then acting as a scourge, and it's our sins in the West that gives the communists their power?
That's partly true, Bernard. But it's worse than that. It's worse than that. We are a scourge already. We are a real moral scourge for ourselves. We are eviscerating morality from our public life and from our mode of education, from our science, from our sociology. I mean, we just are not Christians any longer in our academia, certainly not in the United States, and I doubt it in Canada. Our parliaments in Canada and the United States are not Christian parliaments any longer. They don't consult Christian morality when it's a question of the Gulf, or a question of the baby formula in third world countries, or the production of a B-2 bomber. Morality has nothing to do with all that. This is business, this is politics. So we are our own scourge. Then there's this fact that it is very hard to explain why the West, anti-communist in its ideology, and anti-communist in its political needs of human liberty and the rights of man, the democratic egalitarianism of the West, why we get on with the Russians. The only explanation is that there's a higher power to which we both give obeisance. There's a wider group of men who make both the Soviet Union and us possible. And they have worked out that between these two superpowers, they can corral the world into a new world economic order. And I fear those men. Because they're all powerful. And they finally call the shots. I don't think Mr. Gorbachev can go beyond them. Mr. Khrushchev once made a reference, I forget over what crisis, I think it was the Cuban crisis, but he said, well, it looks as if we're going to have reconciliation and peace with the U.S., but we must consult the Council of Elders. He was the only one time he said that. And it triggers a whole history, as you know, the idea that there is a universal assembly of wise men, very powerful men, who sit at the back of everything in deep armchairs with their cocktails and decide really who wins and who loses, whether it's, and offset whatever the Soviet Union might do with what it allows the capitalist world to do, because both are being directed to produce a godless world. Now, that's something we can never prove, and if you tried to prove it, I think that you wouldn't live very long, but that there is a consortium of men who are both Soviet and American and French, but who are transnational and who have another idea completely how to use the existing powers, including the superpowers, more than one person is convinced, and it's very hard to resist that conclusion. It's very hard to get away from it. It has only two, as I said, they have only two obstacles in their way. One was Islam. One was Christianity. Both are in the process of being liquidated and eviscerated. They'll be used. They can be integrated. It's, of course, because variety is the spice of life. Just as we want to keep folkloric dances in Kansas City or in Kerry Island because they're colorful, but don't let that dominate our parliaments or our politics or our money. So I think that we're on our way to being integrated into a variegated human community, which is purely human. And the sky above is made of steel and the land is made of bronze, and that's it.
Does that perhaps describe why there were these changes in Eastern Europe? It was to bring communism into line with the New World Order. And what is essential Marxism has not really been thrown away.
Oh, no. Marxism is quite safe. In fact, Marxism has spread wider. You know, let me ask you a question about this, Bruno, which really our listeners can ask themselves as I ask you. How did, say, Czechoslovakia get free? How did Poland get free? How did Bulgaria get free? Was there a revolution?
There was a revolution.
Where? Did what arms? Where did they get their arms? Where did they attack the parliament? Did they mob in the streets and demonstrate? Did they wipe out the secret police? Did they suddenly, overnight, a huge army of citizens up like the French Revolution or the other revolution, say, out, out, out? Bernard, let me answer you. It never happened. Miloš Jakeš, who was the head of Czechoslovakia, got a telephone call from Gorbachev saying, step down. Erich Honecker of East Germany, the cruelest of them all, got a telephone call saying, Eric, auf Wiedersehen. Mr. Zivkov of Bulgaria got a telephone call too. The only one who resisted was Ceausescu, and the KGB hunted him down and killed him off. The party was told to fade out politically and let things take their course. There was no revolution. The people didn't. They couldn't revolute. They couldn't rebel. There was no way of rebelling. Suddenly the government ceased to be dominated by Moscow because Moscow gave the orders. Similarly with the Baltic states, we now know the KGB teams went in creating the disruption in the streets, both for Russia and against Russia. This has been a very carefully choreographed charade, all to make the West think that the communist bear has ceased to have claws, and that we can now consort with him, and we can now share our markets with him, and admit him, as we're going to do, into the European Union of Western countries for commerce.
So Marxism really has been modernized. It's not gone.
Oh, no. They're very strong. And Marxism is... The essence of Marxism, what is it? It is this. It's rank materialism as regards money and production. That is rank materialism. That is the essence of Marxism. And the error of Marxism, the basic thing, is that the state runs everything. But I don't know about your Canada very well, because I'm not a citizen of it. I don't study it very much. But I know that we in the United States are coming into a greater and a greater statism, where the state dominates education, dominates sexuality, dominates medicine, and it dominates literature, it dominates the public media. Our media are not free in any real sense of the word. The state is very powerful, and that is a principle of Marxism. True democracy, democratic egalitarianism, wouldn't tolerate that. That's why I think an American of 1850 who woke up in 1990 would say, hey, our liberties are gone. Well, I'm no longer free. So the essence of Marxism is preserved even and is spread. And if you did a tour, I think, of our academic institutions in the United States, certainly, you'd find the majority on the faculties were Marxists. Pure materialists, think the state is okay so long as it pays them their salaries and supports the cause, crushes these religious people who want to change demographic laws about contraception and abortion and euthanasia. They're all behind that. They're strictly Marxist in outlook. And it's very respectable and very looked upon as fashionable. Now there's a surge of a certain American patriotism, and that's what brings in the ordinary people. But the establishment is thoroughly Marxized already in mind. Thoroughly Marxized. And in the countries that were under communist domination, the Marxist, the communist and the Marxist parties have just changed their names. And they say it openly. The Italian Communist Party has just changed its name and call it the Social Democrats or something, or Democratic Socialism or something. But they're still Marxists, and they're still aiming for the Marxist ideal. But the timetable is long. Mr. Gorbachev knows that he has to have the Soviet Union admitted into the Western Union Economic Union, and that's the first, second step. And the third step is that that must be integrated with the United States so that we have one vast market stretching from Vladivostok on the China Sea, across the Russian heartland, across Western Europe, across the Atlantic, all the way to California beaches. One vast human market. In that, then, the Soviet Union knows its materialism and its statism are going to be dominant. They have to be. And that's the victory. Now, Our Lady steps in Fatima and says, it cannot be, because I'm going to step in at the last moment when the world has been penetrated with the errors of Russia, and I'm going to stop it all and turn the wheel back and liberate men from this domination. But you see, that needn't have happened, Bernard, if we had only done what we were told. We didn't do what we were told, and therefore we're paying the price. Because Fatima was either or. Either you do this, or this will happen. We didn't do this, and therefore we are now in the middle of the Fatima or. if I can put it like that.
And Russia is spreading its errors already into the West, because we're already part way to having a Marxist system.
Oh, yes. We are on our way to it. But it's again, people say, oh, no, we have Marxism, because they don't see people in jackboots killing people, and there's no Gestapo working. There's no secret police. The KGB is not sort of under every cellar with a bomb and no assassinations. And they think, therefore, that there's no danger. But Marxism is a thing of the mind and the soul. It has exterior trappings. But its real soul and essence are in the mind and in the way you live. And I doubt if there's much difference between the mentality of the normally Marxized academician or doctor or lawyer or broker or artist today in the United States and those in the Soviet Union who are thoroughgoing ideological Marxists.
Because they have both rejected the rule of God.
That's right. And they both are materialists. And they both too see nothing wrong with statism of a certain kind, which governs procreation, which governs medicine, which governs education. They want their little individual liberties. But that state will allow them because that keeps everybody happy. So there is this Marxism has penetrated very carefully. The and by the way, at the back of it all, of course, is the grinning face of the devil. He knows that once materialism reigns, he has a hold of everything. The greatest proof, I think, Bernard, for us will be the continual unraveling of the most carefully laid plans. We planned something marvelous with Mr. Gorbachev in 1989, 1990. It unraveled. And we found ourselves on the opposite side of the fence in the Gulf. Mr. Gorbachev, wise enough, said, okay, I won't oppose it. No, I'm supplying missiles behind your back and give Saddam his one, try and get him out of the hole. But he wouldn't, no, he's too clever. He's not going to oppose us on that. He knows that Saddam is for the graveyard anyway, soon. And he's only an accident, an ugly, dirty, smelly accident on the way to the new world order. And now we think that once, although we're getting a little bit more cautious, once we have complete military victory, that we now have to win the peace. And we will win the peace in the same way we won the war, by human power. And I tell you, Borat, wait 6 months. Wait 6 months, and we have another conflagration on our hands. And it will unravel in that direction. And then will unravel in another direction. And this is what Our Lady said would happen. It cannot succeed. Both those systems, the Leninist system of Mr. Gorbachev, his Marxism, and the capitalist system, carry the seeds of their own decay within them. And we are carried along with that. You know, the most pathetic thing is that we can't do anything about it. We are helpless because we are now in a systemically godless system. The system has taken over. No matter what you do, the system penetrates because it's systemic. It's throughout all. If you want to live and work, say, in the United States or Canada, there are certain things you can't do. You can't undo the educational system being imposed on us. You can't undo the legislation that favors abortion and euthanasia. You can't undo the permission for fetal experimentation. You can't undo these things any longer. We're in it. And in order to live in peace, you at least have to say, well, they have a right to do it. No, they haven't. Wrong never has a right. But we have to, otherwise you're lampooned. And as you know, in the United States today, we have a thing called the PCP, the politically correct person, and the politically correct and socially acceptable person. And among them are, for the United States, racial quotas, must be in favor of it. Reverse discrimination, you must be in favor of it. Homosexual marriages, you must be in favor. You can't say that homosexuals have no rights to get married to each other. Same-sex parents, fetal experimentation, euthanasia, abortion, contraception. If you sat at a dinner table or went to a lecture hall and condemned any one of these things, you wouldn't talk any further. They'd throw you out. You wouldn't be invited if they know your opinions on these matters. You wouldn't be invited. You are excluded. So in order to live at peace, you just omit all conversation on it. And you don't act with your own children or your friends as if they were doing naughty things when they live together or they abort a child. Or they experiment with their children, or they have in vitro fertilization, or they have embryos tucked away in the local laboratory for the time that they want to breed a child in somebody else's womb. You don't oppose that. That's progress. That's progress. So we're caught in a system today, and the system is all dominant. All dominant. That's our pathos. We are helpless. And what to do about that? That's a long question to answer. It's a question of faith and waiting. Because Our Lady must come. You know, I was speaking to an Irishman a few weeks ago. He's from Boston, but he's a real Irishman. He said to me, I said, God, he said, God must show his face one of these days. There's no solution for it at all. Once more, God must show his face. That was his simple way. Appear up there and say, hey, stop all that nonsense. But no, that's not what the church says. The church firmly believes in Fatima. It knows the authentication of Fatima. It knows it's authentic. And the present Pope and those who are believers still, not in the majority of people amongst the clergy, they are waiting for Our Lady to do something about it. In the meantime, holding on. And we're losing every day in priests and nuns and bishops and practice of the faith. We're losing, losing, losing. But each one will be judged. You know, we were created collectively as a race, but we will be judged singly. And each one will answer. And I must say, I, for my own sins and peccadilloes, I'm afraid when I meet God. Healthy fear. What must you think if you have indulged in the systemic abuses of our way of life? I don't think you can look at God. I think you're self-condemnatory. There was an old Christian tradition, you know, that when any man dies in any part of the world, he has an immediate vision of the crucifix, of the crucified Jesus. And in the light of what he sees, with understanding given him, he knows if he's with that or against it, and he flees or goes where he should go. That it's an instant vision at death everybody has. It's a solid tradition in the church that Augustine speaks about and Jerome and all the saints spoke about. What will most of our contemporaries do when they see the face of the crucified Jesus and see the whole scheme of salvation in his blood and his heart and his crown of thorns and his eyes and know that they have been its enemy all their lives?
Now perhaps we can look at the position of Christianity within this New World Order. You had said that it's in recess throughout the world. Let's take a look at what's happening to Christianity in the Middle East, where the center of the conflict has been recently.
Well, first of all, the Christians are in a vast minority. A vast minority there. Christianity itself, and the Roman Catholic Church in particular, have suffered severe damage in Lebanon already from the 15-year war there, because it was the biggest Christian community in the Middle East, the Maronite Church. They're Roman Catholics, but they're the Maronite Rite, founded by St. Maro back in the 9th or 10th century. They've been liquidated, literally, and they're emigrating and they're dying out. They no longer have power there. They're going to be crushed out by the Muslims, who now have the majority of power there. And they've been decimated in the war and the shelling and the killing that's taken place there. That stronghold of Christianity is on its way out. The second big block of Christians existed in Saddam Hussein's Iraq, the Chaldeans. They're Chaldeans, that is, that it's a rite in the church. They're Roman Catholics. They belong to the Pope, and he appoints their bishops. But they're Chaldean rite, it's a different rite. They say a mass, by the way, in Aramaic, which is the nearest thing to our Lord's language. Unfortunately, they're headed by a patriarch, Raphael the first, Bedawid is his name, who is not only a friend of Saddam Hussein's, but a strong supporter, and who thinks that Saddam Hussein is a saint. He regards him as a personal friend, as I said. He said Saddam would give you the shirt off his back, he's so kind. And when Saddam gassed and killed hundreds of thousands of Kurds in the north of Iraq, Patriarch Raphael said, well, what must a government do when there's an internal revolt? It's got to put it down, hasn't it? This man is amoral. The patriarch is in his judgment. He's desecrating his priesthood and his episcopal dignity. How can he speak like that about it? He knows exactly what Saddam is. He knows Saddam's life. Saddam is married to Sahida, the poor girl, and he has five children by her. He's had a run of mistresses. He's killed off some of them and killed their brothers and sisters because they objected to his fooling around with them. He's an amoral man. He's even broken the laws of his own Sharia, the sacred law of Islam. The patriarch knows this, but in order to have peace, and because Saddam is a friend of his and sends a car for him to bring him out to Baghdad, used to in his heyday, he's not going to offend him. Well, he's very proud of Saddam. But with that leadership, you know, as they used to say about 30 cents and a sandwich of bologna, that you'll get down as far as Grand Central, which is the New York phrase for helplessness. They are completely at sea. Now, they can't convert anybody. They're not allowed to evangelize. They're not allowed to convert any Muslims. They can't preach in public about Christianity. And they have been also reduced in size by Saddam. He's killed many of them, and a lot of them have died in the war. They were drafted deliberately by Saddam and put down in Kuwait. So the church is in bad straits there. Elsewhere in the Middle East, there is no big Christian presence. There's no big Catholic presence. Now, the church, the Roman church, the Pope has his own ambassadors. He has a man in Baghdad, Marian Olesz, Monsignor Marian Olesz, a Polish diplomat who's attached to the Holy See. And he has diplomats all over the Middle East, in every Islamic country. But there is no headway, because Islam is firmly anti-Catholic and firmly anti-Christian. The only thing about Islam is its devotion to Our Lady. It has an amazing devotion to the mother of Jesus, as they call her, Miriam. And there are passages in chapter 41 of the Quran that you could read and get devotion out of them as a Catholic.